I'm Ernst Zündel, president of Samizdat Publishers in Toronto. I'm also the man behind the Voice of Freedom radio and TV broadcasts. I was on trial in Canada for having published a booklet entitled Did 6 Million Really Die? I was first tried in 1985 and again in 1988. The case was disposed of by the Canadian Supreme Court in 1992. The law was declared unconstitutional, which meant that for 9 years I had been dragged through the courts in Canada and through the jails only because I had expressed my constitutional viewpoint, my constitutionally guaranteed viewpoint. During those trials, some illustrious and courageous people came to my defense as witnesses. One of them was a Canadian journalist of British background called Doug Collins. Doug Collins writes in Western Canada, but he used to be quite a famous Canadian journalist on the CBC, Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, and so on. He came into Toronto, testified that this booklet was not hate propaganda and certainly didn't, in his book, constitute false news. And for this act of courage was vilified widely in the Canadian media. At the time, I asked him to allow me to do an interview with him because I'd always been rather fond of him. He was a man who became a prisoner of war in Germany, broke out several times, finally, successfully. In other words, he was somewhat of a hero in my own eyes long before he testified in my court case. Here is Doug Collins, a colorful, illustrious, and courageous Canadian of British stock.
My name is Ernst Zündel. I'm president of Samizdat Publishers in Toronto, Ontario, Canada. I'm with one of Canada's most famous journalists, Doug Collins from Vancouver. I've been a fan of yours for a long time, and today you came to my rescue in the courtroom, so...
Well, I'm not sure about that, but I had a few words to say.
Yeah, well, you certainly strode in there and shook up the media here, according to the news reports. And I want to start out by thanking you.
You're very welcome.
Toronto. I realized that you didn't come for me as a person, because we never met before. Mm-hmm. You knew very little about me. But the principle of freedom of speech and that somebody should have the right to publish their opinions is what was at stake. You being a veteran newspaper mm-hmm. person, and you're not only involved in print media, I heard today in court, but you're also in radio and in television.
Yes.
So mm-hmm. that you are an all-round media person. So this is certainly a good day for me, and I was a lucky man to have you on the stand. I was very interested when you started your testimony this morning by you recounting your escapes from German prison camps. I have never met too many Canadians or British POWs or even Americans that could successfully claim to have gotten away from those nasty Germans.
Well, there are a few, but I wouldn't have mentioned it at all, except that Doug Christie, your lawyer, thought it was relevant because I had been a prisoner in Germany. Yeah. And as I said in court, I was captured at Dunkirk. The battalion of which I was a member, and I was a platoon sergeant in the battalion, was covering the retreat from Dunkirk, the evacuation. Mm-hmm. So there was no chance for us to get out. Of course, we were taken prisoner, and it was difficult to swim 21 miles across the channel anyway.
Right, yeah.
And we were too far from the coast in any case. We were not scheduled for evacuation.
And you knew that?
No, actually not. We suspected it, but in a battle, very few soldiers actually know what's going on, you're there, very pleasant, but you never know what the plan is,
right.
And we didn't, but I don't think it would have made any difference anyway, because we did what we had to do,
mm-hmm.
And so we were taken prisoner, and those of us who were left anyway, and transported to Stalag 8B in Oberschlesien, isn't it?
Yeah.
Or is it Niederschlesien? Lambsdorff, Oberschlesien, I think, yeah, Upper Silesia.
Yeah. How did you get transported there, the method of transport?
Well, we marched from the coast of France to near Luxembourg. It was a long march, and not a very pleasant one. And then we were put aboard French cattle wagons, I suppose you would call them, but in any case, they were marked 40 Homme and 8 Chevaux, you know, it was the old the old style, 40 men or 8 horses. Yeah. And I think there were more than 40 men in the wagon that I was in, but anyway, it was better than walking. Mm-hmm. And we landed up, we went by rail all the way to Lambsdorff in Upper Silesia, and were incarcerated in Stalag 8B. That was the Hauptstalag, you know, the main camp. And from there, it was possible to go out on working parties, which were sub-stalags, you know. Mm-hmm. And some were different from others. They were all prison camps, but it was better than being in the main stalag.
Mm-hmm. Were you given blankets? And I mean, was it warm enough in the huts and all this? How were the living conditions?
Living conditions, to be frank, were not very good. The food was very poor. I have, as a matter of fact, developed jaundice as a result of malnutrition. Eventually, Red Cross parcels started coming through, but by that time, I was pretty well gone. I'd pretty well escaped from Germany by then. I mean, they started coming through in a spasmodic fashion. I will say, for the German army, they didn't steal the Red Cross parcels, which is what I hear the Japanese did. Mm-hmm. They were very honest in that way. And of course, I was a bit of a troublemaker, so I got into a few odd spots of bother. Anyway, I made four attempts to escape from Germany, cut a long story short, and got out of the fourth attempt across Czechoslovakia into Hungary. And we were, my companion and I, a fellow sergeant, were interned in Hungary. We thought that we might be lucky and get to Hungary before the British Embassy left. But we were unlucky, they'd left 10 days previously, and so we were interned, and the Americans looked after our interests, and we went from there.
Mm-hmm. Now, I am particularly interested in how you escaped. You know, there was not very much food, you had only your POW uniform, or did you have like the Germans had here with a circle on?
No, we had sort of the remnants of British uniforms on, and simply saved bits of bread and so on and so forth. This escape was staged in the summer. We had to get through barbed wire and iron bars and all that sort of thing, you know, at night, because it was impossible to get away during the day. We were too closely guarded. But we did that. And we made our way across the fields to the south. And we did have a little bit of a map, which we stole from the German commandant's office. So we were able to determine, I spoke German anyway, and we were able to determine approximately where we were. Also, I had obtained a compass from a French officer. And it wasn't a great compass, but it was a little tiny thing, and it was very useful for determining general direction across country. And we took potatoes out of the fields and carrots and all that sort of thing, you know.
You mean ate them raw?
Ate them raw, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And how many days would you be en route?
We were about 2 weeks, across country. Yeah.
And sleep without blankets at night?
Oh, sleep without blankets, yeah. I mean, of course, you know, I was 20 years old, or 21, mm-hmm. you know, between 20 and 21. And that sort of thing came fairly easy to people of that age, I guess.
Yeah, was there no threat that if you were caught that you might get shot or anything like that?
Not really. I had attempted three times before, and each time was given a sentence in solitary confinement in the main Starag, you know. Mm-hmm. But after the third attempt, the German commandant was getting a bit tired of me, you know, and so he said, "You are not going out." Or at least he didn't say, but his subordinates told me that he had said that I was not going to go out on any more working parties and that I was going to spend the rest of the war in the Stalag, you see, which would have been very difficult for me, because it was very difficult if you're in an inside compound to get to the surrounding compounds and out through the barbed wire and so on. Very difficult indeed. I don't think anyone ever did it. But I managed to change identities with another prisoner, and he became Doug Collins, because he wasn't going to escape anyway, and he knew that. Right. And there was no risk involved as far as he was concerned. It just meant that he had to stay in this compound, you know. Mm-hmm. And at least until they forgot about him. And so I took his identity, and went out onto the working party, and it was, another stalag, a sub-stalag, but it was somewhat easier to get away from. And also, in the sub-stalags, you could get things like files and bits of rope and all sorts of things that were useful, because it was impossible for the German guard to control every movement of prisoners, you know.
Did you get paid for any work that you were doing in the mines you were saying, for instance?
We got some sort of script, a few marks of special camp money, and you could spend, you could spend this in the canteens, certainly in the main stalag. You could buy, I think it was Junak cigarettes, you know, I think, I never smoked myself, but you could buy these things. I think they were pretty horrible, but anyway, it was for those who smoked, you know, a smoke was a smoke. And you could buy that. You couldn't really buy any food or anything. You could buy toothpaste and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. But that was it.
Did you have winter clothing, raincoats, anything for
Nothing.
Your flights?
No.
And didn't the local people, when you were walking, I suppose...
I should point out that we did manage in the main stalag to get into touch with a Pole who was a tailor, and he, I don't know whether it was he or somebody else, no, I think it was a British Sergeant Major that gave me, I got a swastika, you know, what the brown shirts wore?
Yes,
it was on the left arm, wasn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah.
On the left arm. And I had a brown shirt, and something that looked like a brown shirt's trousers, mm-hmm, and boots. And these I took with me. We were always searched, of course, going out of the main stalag again into the working compounds. And I managed to conceal the swastika next to my skin, and the rest of the stuff didn't look anything but ordinary prisoner's clothing, really. But the swastika was very useful, and the brown shirt, for going through villages when we couldn't go round them. Uh-huh. And my companion would follow, say, a couple of hundred yards behind, and I would go in front, doing my best to look like a brown shirt. And we travelled mostly at dusk anyway through villages when it was necessary to do so. And I would hail Hitler and all the rest of it, and nobody took any notice of me.
Hmm. How come you speak German so well for a person?
Well, I learned it at school, elementary German anyway. And of course, I didn't speak German as well when I was a prisoner in Germany, as I subsequently did. But you must remember that when I got to Hungary, I was interned there, and I made the acquaintance of a Polish prisoner who had been a professor in Poland, mm-hmm, and he spoke absolutely perfect German, which a lot of Poles do, as you probably know. And I took lessons from him. And then I spoke German really all the way through Europe, because after I got out of Hungary, I had to escape from there. I got across Yugoslavia into Romania. And really, as you probably know, Ernst, German is, in that part of Europe, a kind of lingua franca. It is the common language of a lot of people. Mm-hmm. Hungarians often speak German. Some Yugoslavs do. German is spoken quite a bit in Czechoslovakia, even, and in Poland, you know. And so... that was the way I really got to know the language a lot better. And then after the war, I was an intelligence officer in Germany, and I used German all day. And so eventually I really began almost to think in German. But, you know, that's a long time ago, and my German is now not bad, but it's a bit rusty. I sometimes have to stop and think of the word, you know, and so I wouldn't be able to pass myself off as a brown shirt now.
No. Yeah, maybe the arthritic arm would
be
brown.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, this is a fascinating story. You escaped finally, you were flown out.
Romania came out of the war.
Right.
That was in August 1944. And I was with the Americans I kept on changing company all the way through. I was with the Americans in Romania, because there had been a very spectacular sort of charge of the light brigade, low-level attack on the Ploiești oil fields in Romania. And I must say, the Americans who did that had some guts, because they went in at about 200 feet in heavy bombers, and they were shot. The Germans knew they were coming and just shot them out of the air like ducks, you know. And there were about 90-odd survivors some guys were just one survivor out of the whole crew of 10, you know. And so I was with, these chaps were sent to a place called Timisul, which is in the Transylvanian Alps. And we, that is my companion and I, the same guy who got out of Germany with me, were in the secret police headquarters originally in Bucharest, and we got out of there and got to the River Danube, where it forms the border. Well, I mean, it's all crazy, isn't it? Where it forms the border between Romania and Bulgaria. Mm-hmm. Our aim was to get to Turkey, and we were within about 150 miles of Turkey, and we were caught crossing the Danube. The Romanians caught us there.
Yeah, but how were you crossing the Danube?
By boat.
Oh, yeah. We were
actually not in the boat. We had detected that there was a boat at this spot. It was all brush covered and everything, like, you know, the area. Mm-hmm. It was sort of wild area. Yeah. And we were seen by a border guard, but he didn't let on that he'd seen us. And we waited there, thinking that when dusk came, we would get across the Danube in this rowing boat, actually. Mm-hmm. And, of course, he went off and got about 20 troops, and they came and arrested us, and we went back to the secret police headquarters.
Yeah.
Actually, the Romanians were, you know, not bad, because they didn't beat us up. They beat up the guards that let us get out.
Oh.
You know, I mean, I understand that the guards who were, should have been watching when we got through the window, because we had a little file, which we had secreted in our boots, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And we got out onto the main street of Bucharest, and I believe we were the only ones ever to escape from the secret police headquarters in Bucharest. And we were on the radio, you know, I mean, they were like, there was a warning out on the Bucharest radio to watch out for these two dangerous characters,
yeah.
You know.
Did you speak any of the Slavic languages?
No,
no.
German was the language, and... Yeah. But somehow, you know, it's not impossible to communicate with people, even if you don't know them, because there are always some key words that people know. Anyway, Romania came out of the war, and King Carol, you know, took the country out of the war, and Antonescu, the Iron Guard, the dictator of Romania, was deposed, and the Americans actually got us out. I mean, they flew in, you see, to get their people out, and there I was flying in high style in a flying fortress right across Yugoslavia, you know, Romania, Yugoslavia, Adriatic Sea into Italy. And it was quite interesting in its way because our plane wasn't attacked, but German fighters came up to attack the group. And there was an air battle going on, like about 20 miles behind us or something. And I thought to myself, Jesus Christ, if I may use that expression, you know, wouldn't it be great to be shot down now? I was actually crapping myself.
Right.
Because to be shot down after all that,
sure.
But still we weren't, and I don't think anybody was shot down. The Flying Fortresses were pretty formidable airplanes, you know, and they had good defenses. And we landed at Bari in Italy, and from there we went back to England. And when I got back to England, I was gung-ho in those days and said, I want to get back, you know, while the fighting's still on. And so I got back.
You came back to Germany at the very end of the war and were in Belsen for a day or...
Yes, not as a prisoner.
No, I understand.
But I was with the forces that liberated Belsen. And I was in Belsen as an interpreter and documents researcher and so on and so forth for about a day. And, you know, it was a very sad scene there, as I explained in court. And, of course, Ernst Kramer, the commandant of Belsen, was a prisoner then. And so was Irma Greise, who was the woman in charge of, the chief woman guard, or female guard there. And both of those were hanged, as you remember. I wonder sometimes now whether Kramer was quite the beast that he was portrayed as being, because... there's no doubt that the conditions in the camp were absolutely awful, and he may not have had the control over those conditions that he would have had if there hadn't been such chaos. It's a possibility, anyway.
Yeah. Did you see much destruction approaching Belsen when you went to?
There was some. Yeah. Well, of course, all the way through Germany, it was a lot of destruction. We crossed the Rhine and up through into the Hanover region and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. And the smaller towns were not so badly damaged, but all the large towns were laid waste.
Yeah.
You know.
Did that, seeing this terrible destruction on some of Europe's great cities, I know that you were very young, and you had had this incarceration, and undoubtedly were not too kindly disposed toward the Germans. Did that make you feel that the German people at least had paid some kind of price for?
Yes, I think it did. Yes, I think it did. But I must be quite honest about it, since you've asked the question, and say that in those days I wasn't very reflective about it all. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I was young, as you say, mm-hmm. and I thought, well, serves them right. I mean, that was my honest reaction to it. But of course, I can't say that I was particularly happy to see a city like Hamburg. I mean, I don't know whether you ever saw it in those days, because you
only in pictures.
Only in pictures. Well, Hamburg, except for a few suburbs, and strangely enough, a little bit right around the center of Hamburg, mm-hmm. was like miles of rubble, and it was very depressing. You know, I mean, it was incredible. Because you know there was a firestorm in Hamburg, yes, in 1943. That was bombed for about 3 days and nights straight. And it was a dreadful scene of destruction.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Did you have a chance to compare the destruction to these German cities with English cities when you were?
Well, yes, to some extent. I hadn't seen Coventry. I never did, in fact, see Coventry in its destroyed state. But I was in London, incidentally, soon after I got back, when the V1s and V2s were coming down. Mm-hmm. And I was in a newspaper man's house, as a matter of fact, or it was a high rise, you know, yeah. An apartment. And a V2, which were the V2, as you know, was the rocket.
Yeah.
And a V2 came down about half a mile away. And blew in all the windows, and the drapes came in, you know, and I thought, my God, you know, that's not too big a mess, and after all my experiences, to be nabbed in London by a V2 wouldn't be too good. So I got out of there as fast as I could.
This may be an unfair question. Don't answer it if you don't like to answer it. You fought for values which you believed in the Second World War. Mm-hmm. And you obviously put up a damn good fight. And now you have lived in Canada for most of your adult life.
Yes, right.
From
1952.
Do you feel a little betrayed by what has happened to this society?
You know, in Canada?
Yeah, by politicians giving away really what you men thought you were protecting for with your own bodies. Many of your comrades died in the mm-hmm. defense of the values, and here we are.
Yes, I do. Well, let me say this. I'm vastly disappointed in the Canada of today. I think that many of the values that existed even 15 or 20 years ago no longer exist, or are on the way out. I don't, for example, see much purpose to our immigration policies today. I think that that despite all the cries of racism directed against people like myself who do oppose the immigration policies, Canada was a happier place when it was the old style, traditional immigration, you know, immigration from Europe and the United States and so on and so forth. And I see no purpose in the multicultural policies. We are slipping into a kind of society where you have to have special classes in schools, which cost a lot of money for people who use English as a second language. And that applies, of course, particularly to Orientals and Asiatics and so on and so forth, because they don't find it as easy as, say, Germans coming to Canada to pick up English. And why are we doing this? Because the people of Canada, I wouldn't really have an objection if the policy had been put fairly to the people of Canada and they'd been asked, look, do you want this kind of immigration? But it was changed without anyone consulting them in 1967. Universal immigration was introduced. And concomitant with all this, we have human rights commissions and so on, affirmative action. I mean, What is happening is that a whole new ball game has been organized without the people being consulted. Sure, they can vote against the politicians at election time, but if all three parties are so eager for the immigrant vote that they agree that, yes, you know, we must have this kind of immigration, then what's the man in the street to do? Every poll that has been taken since the war, and I've studied this at great length and in some detail, has demonstrated without any doubt that Canadians do not want this kind of immigration, yet they're powerless to do anything about it. So in that sense, democracy is useless for them.
Do you have an answer what could be done?
Well, I have an answer as to what could be done. I would return to the immigration policies that we had before 1967. There was no universal immigration. The emphasis was on European and Australian, what you call the white commonwealth immigration, or white commonwealth as such. I would not exclude Asiatics and others from coming in, but I would not let in any more than a certain proportion. It averaged about something like between 5 and 10% in those other years. And I certainly would not open immigration offices all over the world to add to the problems that this country has. You know, I think that, I don't really think that politicians give a damn. You know, they're just interested in whether they can get a vote from this ethnic association and the other one, and the squeakiest wheel is always the one that gets the grease, as you know. But I think that there isn't any question that people would return to the status quo ante if they could, as far as immigration is concerned. I would let in a certain number, as I say, of these people, but I would not let it become predominant. You know, most people don't realize, or maybe they do, I don't know, but it seems to me that they don't. We're now in a situation where most of the immigrants are from the third world.
Yeah.
And I'm not suggesting that I am superior to them. I don't think they're superior to me either. You know, everyone pays his money and takes his chance. But I don't see any purpose in creating a situation which has shown itself all over the world to be impractical. And it makes no sense at all to me. Yeah. And I think that we are going to be faced, and are faced to a great extent already, with the problems that these other countries have had.